until last year, Texas ERCOT, like every year, was like Christmas. This year, there were some changes in regulations at how ancillary services were being dispatched in the market, and they depressed prices. ERCOT has always been a place that would surprise everybody every now and then. A place that you're going to have all of a sudden a major market volatile time and just make a lot of money for asset owners. So ERCOT is going to come back, especially with all the crypto assets that are being installed in ERCOT. It's a huge load addition. If there's a resource in PJM that's available right now or for the next 3 years, they can make a lot of money off of the capacity market. And there's an expectation that by 2030, there's going to be 50 gigawatt extra load coming in PJM, and there would be 40 gigawatt of retirement. So putting those together, there's a huge gap that generators have to fill.
Hello and welcome back to Transmission. Today, we're diving into the diverse strategies employed by operators of battery energy storage systems across some of the US markets. These approaches vary significantly depending on the regional markets they serve, the policies shaping their respective ISOs, and a host of other factors. But it's not just storage making waves. Emerging players like cryptocurrency miners are becoming active participants in US energy markets, contributing to grid stabilization efforts. Joining us for this episode is Ali Karimian, Market Optimization Director at Grid Beyond. Ali explores the evolving trends in energy operations and markets and unpacks how crypto mining is becoming a vital piece in the grid stability puzzle. As always, if you're enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode and give us a rating wherever you listen. Let's jump in.
Ali, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is the second time we've had someone from Grid Beyond on. We're going to talk about how batteries make money in a few markets in the US, which is, of course, right up our street. And we're also going to talk about crypto miners doing DSR, which is, I mean, we had Jamie McCavity on the podcast, 20 episodes ago, and it was absolutely incredible, that conversation. So really looking forward to talking about that as well. Ali, before we get started, how long have you been at Grid Beyond? And can you just give us the lowdown about what you do there before we jump straight into the detail?
Yeah, happily. I've been with Grid Beyond for a year and a half. I started at the company mainly to develop the optimization side of front-of-the-meter batteries in the US. And now my team is also responsible for optimization in Japan. So I would really want to think of it as North America plus Japan. And the team that we have is responsible for developing, like making money for batteries that are located in these jurisdictions.
Okay. So are you doing optimization in Japan from the US, or are you doing optimization in Japan in Japan?
I think you're asking some security questions over here. The team that the bulk of the data science team is in Ireland. And the rest of the data science team is, we have some people in Vietnam, some in West Coast, Midwest, and I am myself on the East Coast. So people are really everywhere.
So Grid Beyond are, of course, very famous in the demand side response DSR space.
Yeah.
And then now you guys optimize batteries around the world and do lots of edge technology stuff, which is very interesting. But let's frame this discussion, right? So we're going to talk about the first half. We're going to talk about how batteries make money in ERCOT, California, and PJM. And that's going to be a fascinating discussion. And then we're going to talk a little bit about crypto miners as emerging participants in the market and what you guys are doing in that space, which will be very interesting too. So let's talk about batteries to begin with. What's Grid Beyond doing with batteries in California, in PJM, and Texas?
You know, we have a whole host of offerings that we have for like different types of players. Like we essentially provide an a la carte menu. If it's a huge company, they have a portfolio of batteries or any other type of asset. They just want to buy forecasting from us, or they just want to buy our platform from us. We provide that. If they have their own in-house trading team, if it's a company that they want to have some help from us with trading, we also provide that. And there are also companies that they can be pretty large. They have a portfolio of batteries usually around the world. And they, for example, have a new installed battery in ERCOT or CAISO. They don't want to hire a new trading team. They'll hire us. Like we are we can work with them, make money off of the battery for them. They don't have to worry about anything. And we just get a cut of the revenue.
And so on a battery front, we're talking about grid scale batteries, right? We're talking about front of the meter systems.
Absolutely.
And you guys, they give you the keys to the asset. It's the optimizer model, right? Give you the keys to the asset and you guys take a cut and you get paid more if you make more for the client. And so, and what does your organization look like then? So if you've got market access in ERCOT and California and PGM, and you've got different trading strategies for these markets, what does your organization look like? And I say that because I think about folks, you know, other optimizers who, like Habitat, for instance, who have been very successful in ERCOT, but it's just so much work to do these additional new markets. And they will get coast to coast, no doubt, but it takes so long because it's so, so hard to do and to do properly. And that's not, there's no diss there. There's no diss on Habitat or anyone. It's a comment on how complicated and disparate these markets are. So how are you guys doing that in three markets already? Do you have a really big team?
We don't. I think we are really good software programmers first and foremost. And then we are also power traders. Like as an example, like my own background is I have a PhD in machine learning. And then I worked in financial markets. I worked in renewable energy companies. And now at Grid Beyond, I've done power trading. So I have both backgrounds. We have a really good team of software people that they're extremely good at what is called object-oriented programming. So when we started programming, and ERCOT was the very first market that we started writing our platform for. Like we had this in mind that everything is done in object-oriented way, meaning that like think of it as like you want to build a car. If you want to build a car, let's say you first build a Mercedes Class C, and the next thing you want to build is like a BMW, let's say just Series 6. Like one way is that when you're done with your Series C, you're going to start from ground up and go to your BMW. The other way is that you create modules when you're working on your Mercedes-Benz, that those modules you're making them general enough that you can customize it to build your next car that may be very different. For us, it's a similar story that we had this in mind that all of these markets have a lot of similarities and at the same time, a lot of differences. So what would be like if we're writing classes in a programmatic way that we can write this whole platform for ERCOT and then we want to tweak it as minimal as possible to take it to CAISO, to PJM, to Japan, and all the other ISOs that like I think next we're going to go also to New York and Nepal. We can do all of these expansions pretty quickly because the platform that we have written is extremely customizable. And at the same time, our team is really hardworking. Everybody is very passionate about what they do. Everybody really wants to do good quality work all the time, and they put the energy into it.
I find it remarkable because we, our experience at Modo Energy, not to go off tangent here, is, but a lot of what we do is building models, right? And forecasts, long-term forecasts. And we do that so people can go to the bank and they can raise money or they can value their asset or whatever. And I don't take that lightly. I don't mean whatever as in whatever. I mean, as in this is a big, big piece of work. And so for us, about half of our company is working on that. And we don't even interface with the market, right? So we build a dispatch, we forecast power curves and we build dispatch models that simulate battery behavior in different markets. And even that, we don't even interface with the actual market. We're not submitting trades. We're not doing, we're not moving money around. There's no, there's lots of ways where our job is less challenging than the folks who are doing the actual optimizing.
Sure.
We're within this nice safe box at Modo Energy. And even then, you know, the capital expenditure to build our models is just eye-watering. If we knew how hard it was to build a model for ERCOT and California before we started doing it, we may not have chosen to do it, to be honest. And so then I look at other optimizers like Grid Beyond who are somehow in so many different markets, and it just blows my mind. It blows my mind because I don't know, maybe we're doing something wrong or maybe we go to a different level of detail. I don't know, but we've found it quite different, you know, and we found each market to be very different, and we've had to rewrite the rule book pretty much for every mark. We were hoping that we could build 80% of the model and then 20% on top, you kind of tune to each market. And what we found is, you know, what you can cross over between Great Britain and ERCOT is very little. And the same between even two markets that look similar, like ERCOT and California, we've found we've had to, there's so much rebuild that goes on between markets. So just a comment really that I look at optimizers like you guys who are in Japan and lots of states in the US and across Europe, and it just blows my mind.
I agree with you. I think it really helps that like a couple of senior people at our company, they've had experience with different ISOs to begin with, like including myself. Like before joining Grid Beyond at Constellation, I was active in PJM, Nepal, and New York, as I supported a trading desk over there for wholesale side. And went to Key Capture Energy. I was in charge of the ERCOT trading, not in charge of ERCOT trading desk, but helped over there. And we have other people at the company that they're very experienced. They've been active in the UK market, in the Ireland market. And just this whole experience of people coming together, knowing the commonalities, it really helps with starting to work on that object-oriented programming the way I said that you can. Like if you have a very good starting point that you know what needs to be tweaked, next time that you're working it for another market, it's going to be faster. Like what we came up with was that like for our ERCOT platform, it took us almost a full year to write ERCOT from scratch. Once we did ERCOT for CAISO, it was, I would say, 6 months. For Japan, it was 4 months. And my guess is that when we want to do this for New York or New England, it's going to be around 2 to 3 months. Like we are at the point of seeing so many different models, knowing what are the questions to ask, because to me, that's always a big one. Like nobody is an expert in everything, but a huge part to us is when we're entering a new market, just even knowing what question to ask and finding people that are really good at answering those questions quickly for us so that we can hit the ground running as fast as possible and just build our platform in the new market.
So let's talk about markets that batteries operate in. And which markets are attractive? Can we just do a high-level overview of which markets are attractive for batteries to operate in, especially in the three that we're talking about, so in Texas, California, and PJM?
So Texas this year had a really bad year. Everybody knows that. I'm sure you're aware of this. Until last year, Texas ERCOT, like every year, was like Christmas. People could pay off their batteries in 2 to 3 years. It was amazing. This year, there have been multiple factors. We had a webinar on this. Like in short, sure, like everybody talks about weather and renewables, but also like there were some changes in regulations at how ancillary services were being dispatched in the market, and they depressed prices. I don't think if ERCOT is going to stay low forever. ERCOT has always been, as far back as I know, a place that would surprise everybody every now and then. A place that you're going to have all of a sudden a major market volatile time and just make a lot of money for asset owners. So ERCOT is going to come back, especially with all the crypto assets that are being installed in ERCOT. It's a huge load addition that will just help the prices be volatile and high enough that if somebody is installing a battery, they're going to make their money. CAISO has been a more stable place because they have a resource adequacy program. People do get paid usually for 10 years, like they've hedged a big chunk of their revenues for 10 years. And that helps them not be in panic mode if 1 year they're not making enough money in the market. It's one of those places that I haven't seen a company that gets widely rich off of their batteries in CAISO. But people do well because of resource adequacy. It's a place with nice returns. PJM is a very interesting place. Until just this year, that capacity market had a major change. Like this year, for people that have followed, PJM has a construct called capacity, in which the market procures generation to be available whenever they're called. Capacity market, until this year, was not as lucrative. Prices were clearing low. PJM made some changes in how they procure capacity and formulas that they use for market clearing price. And all of a sudden, prices are clearing really high. So if there's a resource in PJM that's available right now or for the next 3 years, in the next 3 years, they can make a lot of money off of the capacity market. The view that we have and a lot of other people have is that this is going to continue for the foreseeable future. And that goes to two factors. Like there's an expectation that by 2030, there's going to be 50 gigawatt extra load coming in PJM, then and there would be 40 gigawatt of retirement. So putting those together, there's a huge gap that generators have to fill. However, PJM is a little bit tricky. Like there's an extremely long interconnection process. In ERCOT, it takes less than 2 years. The time that you apply to be connected to the point that you receive your approval that, yes, now you can build your asset. In PJM, from the time that you enter the queue to even apply for interconnection to the time that you come out, even before any construction starts, just the approval is 4 years. So if you're going now, you're going to come out of it in 2028 or 2029. PJM has been very slow. So now it's really good for operating batteries, absolutely. But how many operating batteries are in PJM? There are very few. Very few. We do have positive outlook on PJM. Like a lot of projects are now penciling in PJM, both behind the meter and front of the meter. And we expect people to have like payback in the range of 5 years. Even some areas such as Mid-Atlantic, I live in Maryland, Baltimore. Here in BGE zone, capacity prices are clear really high, and Dominion, Virginia. In both of these places, like if you have a battery behind the meter or front of the meter, it's going to pay off very soon. Very lucrative. And I know you asked about PJM, CAISO, and ERCOT. Like one other place that we entered, as I said, was Japan. Japan is an extremely interesting place. It just shows how much these markets can be unexpected.
Take it from the top. Tell us, act like we know nothing about the Japanese power market. And tell us like we're five-year-olds. What's the state of the market in Japan at the moment?
The state of market in Japan right now is it's bimodal. For a huge group of people that participate in the market, there are utility companies that are, a lot of them are state-owned. Their mandate is not to make money, so they're supporting and they're providing power essentially at their cost. And there is a very small percentage of the market right now that are private owners, and they're open to, they're just starting to participate more. And that's just because Japan, they opened the market. First, they opened it to energy in late 2019-ish. And then earlier this year, it was just April of this year, that they opened the ancillary service market to new participants, like to essentially anybody that is not a utility, they are not state-owned, like people like us, as long as you have, or you, if you have a battery, you can participate in the market.
And it's a really thin market though, isn't it? The ancillary services market.
You would think so. However, like the amount that the Japanese ISO wants to procure is still way above how much is actually available. So because of that, price is clear really high. And in fact, there is one very interesting difference between Japan and American market is that in America, the price that everybody gets paid is the cleared price. And that seems pretty obvious in the American construct that, like, for example, let's say you and I are both participating in the market. You provide, let's say, offer capacity for $50 per megawatt hour. I offer it for, let's say, 100. If market clears at 40, both of us are going to get paid 40. You get paid at the cleared price. In Japan, energy is paid as cleared. However, capacity ancillary services are paid as bid, which means that as long as you're cleared, you're going to get paid exactly how much you were bid. So it's a game theory of you want to bid as much high as possible, as long as you know that you're going to get cleared.
I miss those days. We used to have ancillary services used to be procured like that a long time ago in the UK. And it was crazy, right? Because back in the day, these were in some cases 2 years or even up to 30 month contracts for what was FFR at the time. And it wasn't pay as clear. And you got this Excel sheet once a month to figure out who got what contracts. And you could have the same, for the same service, you know, one project was getting 15 quid, 20 quid a megawatt an hour, and the other one might have been getting £4. It was tragic at times. And it was, because it wasn't very liquid, there weren't that many participants. It was very difficult to optimize your bidding. Everyone thought they had some sort of edge. But I think looking back, how could you, when you only get feedback on an auction once a month and there's only, say, 15, 20 bidders. But anyway, that's I do miss those days because it's like the Wild West. And in
it is.
Illiquid markets, there is an argument that the cost of the end procurer or consumer is lower in payers bid markets because so many people miss out. So many bidders are desperate to win contracts. I get the argument for payers clear. I think they call it a Dutch auction, don't they? Payers clear makes sense if everyone's bidding at their marginal cost and it should drive it down for everyone. But in thin, illiquid markets, you can make an argument the other way. So Japan, did they choose to do that recently or has it always been that way?
It's after March of 2024. It's very recent.
Wow.
Exactly as you said. So good for them, good for everybody that's new there. So we're saying two different things. One of them is a huge chunk of the market are, again, state-owned utilities. They are offering their capacity at very low price at their cost. And that's what a huge chunk of the ancillary services are going to be procured at. However, there are also other providers that are more recently entering, right? That they get clear that, and demand response also, by the way, can participate. So you can have, as a load, you can participate and you can make a lot of money in Japan right now. One of the very interesting phenomena that we've seen is that some of these companies, like Japanese battery companies, even that they have installed batteries because they installed them to test their battery technology. Now they're bringing those test batteries to the market because like now all of a sudden, like they installed that, like let's say 5 years ago because they were testing a new technology, but they can make a lot of money off of it, off of a test plant that they never expected to make money off of.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And so that's a whistle-stop tour of those markets, right? And how much of your time is spent in doing US stuff versus Japanese stuff?
Japanese stuff at this point is very cyclical because we have two battery projects coming online in spring in Japan. We also have a huge project coming online in Kaiso in the spring. And we have a decent portfolio coming online also in ERCOT in spring. At the same time that we're always like making sure that for our current customers, everything that we're doing is like really top of the line and as best as can be done. I don't think if it's as easy as saying that, hey, 10% or 20% of my time is on Japan. One thing that I can say is that all the calls happen at late at night. And those are brutal. Brutal for my daughters, for my wife, everybody.
Oh, no, no. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. We just opened an office in Sydney and we, so we've got a few people in Sydney and we do a company all hands, which is what it says it is on the tin, right? Everybody in the company is on a call and there's loads of high fives and welcoming new joiners and you know, all the good stuff. And it's really important to invest in that when you're in multiple places. But then now we've got these folks in Sydney and there isn't a time. If your working hours are 9 to 6, there isn't a time where you can schedule it where everyone can join it. So we have this kind of northern hemisphere all hands now, and we've got to figure out a way to somehow either bend the space-time continuum or find some other way of making everybody feel included. Maybe we take it in turns or something. But yeah, it's really tricky to run a business in that many time zones. Anyway, we digress. So as somebody who knows an awful lot about these markets, could you give our listeners a heads up on any policy or regulatory changes that you think are going to be really big in these markets that's coming up in the next couple of years or so?
Yeah, let's start one at a time. ERCOT, the big one is closer to the end of this year, next year. They're going to have a whole new framework for how they're going to procure ancillary services and energy. Like they're calling it RTB Plus, it's real-time plus. Battery optimization framework that they essentially are going to have an ancillary service market in real time as well. Because in ERCOT currently, there is the only market for ancillary services is in the day ahead. In California, it's a different story. California has also real time and day ahead. So does PJM. So once ERCOT implements that, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of new paradigm shift in the market that's at this point, We believe we have a good grasp of them. We believe that we are ready. At the same time, there are always going to be challenges that will come to anybody, even to the most ready people. When it comes to PJM, what comes to my mind is mainly now regarding the capacity market. There is a dance created that for years, generators have not been happy with the price that capacity market has been clearing at. Like, they thought it was very low. And now that it's at a level that generators are happy, consumer protection groups are not happy, because they rightfully say that, well, this price of capacity is always coming from ratepayers. And in fact, I believe I read very recently that the expectation is next year, electricity prices in my hometown of Baltimore are going to go up by 20%. And 20% is a big chunk, like all of a sudden getting added to your energy bill. So now consumer protection groups are advocating for ways to bring that capacity price down. We don't think if that's going to happen, mainly because with all of this load retirement, load going up and generator retirement, it's really hard to imagine there's something to make up for it. There isn't like all of a sudden added generator from thin air to make up for this. But anything that gets into politics of populism and popularity with consumers, there's always this added dynamic of we don't know what's going to come next. And in CAISO, I can't think of anything. They're always making some changes. CAISO is very dynamic. They're always updating something with their batteries, with like how they, for example, deploy ancillary services or even how they publish information. As of now, we don't think if there's going to be a major shock to anything.
Okay. Yeah, the PJM story is a big one, isn't it? Because there's just so much industry in PJM that is so vulnerable to changes in power prices. There's the consumer side for sure, but it really is an industrial heartland in PJM. And I can see why it's becoming political. And capacity forecasts as well look like it's going to continue for a while, which is really exciting from a generator's perspective. But you can have too much of a good thing, can't you? And things can swing back the other way. All right, let's move on from batteries for a second. I want to talk about crypto miners, because you've spent a bit of time in this space. And what we find is whenever we talk about crypto mining, the amount of attention this gets on our podcast, not that we do things for clicks and likes, of course, but we do like a bit of dopamine every now and again. Whenever we talk about crypto mining, it's just something goes off in people. They love it. And so for you, you've been looking at crypto miners as participants in power markets and a few different strategies they can take. So before we get started there, I mean, we're mainly talking about ERCOT here, right? So could you just talk for a second about the characteristics that make crypto miners suitable for grid stability?
Yeah. I also want to make it clear that when it comes to crypto miners, what we have come across is that there are two types of crypto miners. There's a whole category of crypto miners that they're usually companies that they own a facility and they rent out the capacity to mine, let's say, Bitcoin on their facility. Those are types of facilities that they usually have very strict availability constraints, like meaning that they say like 99% of the time facility has to be available. Those types of facilities, there are fewer opportunities for them to make money by participation in the power market. Of course, like they can always like install a battery behind the meter, and like there are always ways for any type of facility to find added revenue. The best type of facilities that we work with, and they can definitely make a lot of money by participation in power markets, are people that own the facility and they mine the Bitcoin or any other crypto asset on their own. So they don't have anybody else that they have to report to about availabilities. And by the way, like when I'm talking about availabilities, most of these strategies that we optimize, they have like 97%, 96% availability per year. It's not that like we're going to all of a sudden put a huge block on the facility. But even the capability to say that I have some flexibility, instead of 97%, I can be 96%, 95% available. and I don't have to be responsible to a stakeholder. That opens our hands very much in helping them with lowering, essentially we are lowering the effective power price, right? Because like there is a power price that they are paying. And if we can find other ways for them to make money in the market, that brings down their effective cost of electricity, which for a Bitcoin miner is the largest expense. I would say crypto miners are generally fast to respond. They are not extremely fast. They are not like batteries. They have a ramp up and ramp down rate. So because of that, they can participate in ECRS, RRS in ERCOT and non-spin, not regulation. Regulation is like you have to be faster for that. And one huge distinction is that if you are a controllable load or non-controllable load, like most of crypto miners are non-controllable load, meaning that the only decision to be made is zero or one, like thinking of it as like a switch that's connected to a light bulb. If it's non-controllable, you only have two options. Either if it's on fully or you just turn it off, shut it down. A controllable load is a situation that like you have a dimmer. You can dim the light bulb if you need to. And with controllable load, you just have more opportunities to participate in the market and make more money, which comes at the expense that now you have a little bit less control on how you're running your facility, because with changes in the frequency on the grid, you're providing reliability to the grid, and you just have to be more flexible.
Yeah, and one of the things that's interesting about, I'll talk mainly about Bitcoin mining because I'm fairly opinionated on anything that's not Bitcoin. But the cool thing about it is your settlement period is basically 10 minutes, right? Because it's a new block every 10 minutes. So your load is essentially just cooling load. There's some core power, but it's generally cooling, some like hash power, but most of it's cooling. And then you're looking at a 10-minute on and off time, really. And you want to be on to hash for as long as you can within a 10-minute period, which syncs quite nicely with a lot of power markets. So there's a ton of data center and crypto load coming on, or Bitcoin mining load coming on in ERCOT right now. What about the other markets? Are we seeing big build out in California and PGM in the same sort of way, and Japan? Or, I mean, the exceptional thing about ERCOT is the low base load power prices, because you know your dollar per kilowatt hour or cent per kilowatt hour is just so low in Texas. And especially in West Texas, where you can access a lot of negative pricing. So what about these other markets? Are they attractive? And is there much activity happening there?
Yeah, we've seen some good activities in SPP specifically, like Indiana, North Dakota, South Dakota. Power prices, like construct over there is also very good. Like a lot of these large companies that they started in like China or even Norway, now they have... in Texas, South Dakota, facilities that they're all pretty profitable for them. And one thing that I forgot to add about these strategies was that like they can also provide out-of-the-money call options. That's something that like many people don't think about. And the concept is that if you have a facility that you can shut it down when power prices are high, you can which is something that a lot of people do. There's nothing novel about that. It's called high price avoidance, right? That's very obvious. Like power prices are high, just shut it down. However, you can sell this as a service. You can sell this as a service even 1 year in advance or one season in advance. You can sell the right to shut down your facility as a call option. And usually people that are on the other end are people that need to buy that call option because they have a load book. It can be like a utility or it can be a load serving entity. And after Storm Uri, it's been pretty hard. Like not everybody underwrites call options out of the money in ERCOT anymore because everybody is really afraid of that fat tail that can happen. And now that crypto miners, there are few crypto miners that are sophisticated enough to know how to do this and how to manage this, because like there are risks that come with this. And that's, by the way, something that we do help people with, like both for selling their call option and managing it, managing their crypto so that they don't have to worry about what they sold. that they can really make a lot of money on and essentially bring the effective cost of electricity down. Because conceptually, what's happening is that you're selling volatility, like in an option world. You're selling the volatility of power prices. And there's a premium for that. It's like selling insurance. You're selling insurance.
So looking to the future, thinking about battery and or crypto mining, where are the opportunities that you guys are seeing and where are your clients focused on at the moment?
Right now, a lot of people are excited about PJM. A lot of people. Like we have a lot of, like similar to what you described as the arm of your business that you sell bankable forecast for people. We have a similar arm of the business that we provide long-term project evaluations. And in PJM, as of now, we see a lot of demand for people coming over for both behind the meter and front of the meter. And we also have a side of our business that we provide behind the meter batteries, our own financing. And because we're also scheduling coordinator, like we essentially bundle everything, like it's a one place shop, just like get everything from one place. PJM, especially Mid-Atlantic region, because capacity prices are so expensive, right now, if you have a battery in, you can easily look at like a payback of 2 to 5 years. And that's pretty amazing.
So the Mid-Atlantic region is where it's at right now?
That's Maryland and Dominion, Virginia, as of now.
Very cool. All right, now on to the last two questions. My favorite question. So the first one is, if there's anything you want to plug, now's, this is the Grid Beyond sales pitch, or you want to announce a big project or product, this is your chance to do it.
Yeah. You know, we're very excited. Like we are into an agreement with a very large OEM, a battery OEM, and we are bringing in essentially our platform to the physical capability of a project. Because so far, right now, all of the platforms, it's the role of a human. That as a human, you would know that, hey, I'm putting this project on stress, or I should like provide less of high volatile type of products, such as like regulation up, regulation down. I don't want to do this in like multiple days in a row, because that may result in outage for the project, and I may just lose the whole project. That's a role of a trader. What we are doing, working with this very large OEM, is that we're going to receive feedback from their projects in real time, and like through the functionalities that we both of our teams are building together, we want to eliminate the role of that human trader and put everything on machines. That like the machine would decide that, hey, now this is a time that the bids and offers have to be more tamed, or bids and offers can be more aggressive, depending on like how much trust you have that the project is going to perform and not get into outage. We are really excited about all of these areas that we're working at. I think I'm really excited about the whole team that we have. Very sharp people, lovely to work with. And every day that I work with them, I'm genuinely happy to start my computer and start chatting with them.
All right. And okay, now onto my favorite question. This is where all the naughtiness comes out. This is the contrarian view. What's the thing that you believe, Ali, that not a lot of, ideally, less than 50% of the rest of the world believe, but as small a percentage as possible and as controversial as possible, please, if you will?
You know, it's not a contrarian view. What I am very excited about is, like there are these melted metal batteries that people have been working on in lab, and a few of them are getting commercialized. I'm really excited about them coming to the market and at some point us managing them. Because like as of now, like when you're charging the battery, you're always expending energy. But there are many situations like let's say at a steel manufacturer, you have a ton of just excess heat that just goes to waste. If you can use that energy to charge your battery, that would be amazing. I think that's going to be really helpful for these industries and just for global warming as a whole. And this is also not a contrarian view. However, I'm very excited about the role of big data. Like a lot of people talk about big data. At the same time, implementation of big data properly is extremely hard. And we are spending a lot of time and energy on figuring out how to get all of these available data from different resources that are publicly available and just make more use out of them. Not just obvious ones of, hey, like this is what ERCOT has published and this is it. Like we really are trying to find other resources that are publicly available and get more information for our asset management.
All right. So a couple of things in there. Using heat better. I think there is so much energy spent in heat. I won't say wasted, but it ends up being wasted. So totally behind you on that. And then, there's a big role that data's got to play. So Ali, I want to say a massive thank you for joining us on the podcast. It's lovely to have you on. And we got some hot tips in there. You got to check out the Atlantic region. Atlantic region, Central Atlantic region.
Mid-Atlantic.
And lots of other stuff in there too that our listeners are going to find really interesting. So thank you for joining us on the podcast and see you soon.
It was an honor and pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Transmission, a Modo Energy podcast. Transmission delivers conversations from industry leaders and experts exploring energy markets and the operations and technologies related to grid-scale battery energy storage. Check out our other episodes by searching Transmission wherever you get your podcasts. Check out the Energy Academy, our video crash course on how markets in Great Britain and ERCOT work, or head to modoenergy.com to see our written research. Thanks for listening.